like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome back to She Pivots. I am Chandrika Tandon.
Welcome to She Pivots, the podcast where we talk with women who dared to pivot out of one career and into something new and explore how their personal lives impacted these decisions. I'm your host, Emily Tisch Sussman. Welcome back, pivoters. This week, I'm delighted to share my conversation with Chandrika Tandon. While you may not recognize her name immediately, I can guarantee she's influenced your life in one way or another. She made a name for herself as the first Indian American woman to become a partner at McKinsey and worked firsthand with some of their biggest clients in the 1970s and 80s. From there, she founded her own business, Tandon Capital Associates, where she created billions in market value. Like so many of our pivoters, Chandrika was the top of her game when she decided to make her pivot. Poised to sign a massive deal with a European company, sadly, she was under NDA, so we don't know the company. She came to a crossroads. What did she want her life to look like? Was she fulfilling that vision through the massive success and business she had had until that point? Was she enriching her life through art and learning like she loved to do when she was a child? Stay tuned to hear what Chandrika decided, how she moved forward with intention, how music became the through line through it all, and how in the end, she became a Grammy-nominated artist. Enjoy!
My name is Chandrika Tandon, and I run a company, I run a foundation, and I'm on a few boards. I'm a tripartite person. I'm a businesswoman, I'm a person who cares about society, and I'm an artist.
So when you were young, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up?
I really didn't know what I wanted to be, but I was born in a very small village, in a very small town in India. And we didn't have the internet there. I'm 69 years old, so we didn't have, my world was just a world of books. So my plans for myself was that I was opening my world, opening the windows of the world through books.
Growing up, Chandrika lived with her parents, siblings, and her grandfather. Being the oldest sibling, she grew close with her grandfather and credits him with leaving an indelible mark on her and expanding her world through books.
He was the love of my life. I'd come back from school and go straight to him, and I read all 37 plays of Shakespeare and all kinds of obscure works and poetry and all that, because every evening I'd sit with him.
Wow.
And it's a wonderful example of someone who brought himself down to me, you know. So when I got involved with doing crossword puzzles, my 70-year-old grandfather, he was in his 70s or maybe older than that, he would start to understand how to do crosswords. When I got into chess, then he started to play chess actively. So he was always my companion doing what I was doing. And so that created such a bond between us.
What do you think he imparted upon you? What did he bring out of you?
He opened so many windows into a world which I didn't know existed. So we would read books like Thackeray. I mean, you probably, you know, they aren't normally read now. They're old English authors. But, you know, the history of Pendennis, which is a very boring book as you look at it. But, you know, years later, actually, about 5-10 years ago, I was doing a walking trip in Cornwall and went to Pendennis. There's actually a place called Pendennis. But, you know, there you're sitting in Madras, which has no internet, which is not connected to any other part of India, let alone any other part of the world. And you're reading about faraway places, ancient times, different cultures, different traditions, because all we had was books. Some we had at home, but we would keep going to the British Council Library and the lending libraries and just read and read and read. So he gave me the love of books, because every night I had a tradition with him. There was a small black stool, and I would sit on the stool with him where he would get a cup of raisins. So I would eat a cup of raisins with him where for 1 hour we had to just read. And it didn't matter. And I'd be falling asleep on this little stool because it didn't have a back support. But my vivid memory is sitting there. But while you were uncomfortable and falling asleep and it wasn't homework time, whenever I think of that bench, I think of Pendennis and I think of Cymbeline and I think of Macbeth and Hamlet and School for Scandal of, you know, Sheridan's rivals. I mean, I've read so much and I memorized 200 poems. My mother's plans for me, however, were that I would be married by the time I'm 18, which was a legal age for marriage. So she was busy collecting my trousseau from the time I was 3, because, you know, when you have the misfortune, quote unquote, of having a girl, you have to provide for her dowry. So my mother was completely focused on that. So the messages I was getting at home is, you will be married and off you'll go. But I, on the other hand, was reading Shakespeare, was reading all kinds of books and imagining some windows, some doors, something opening. But I didn't know what that was exactly.
Did you feel like your mother thinking about your future as just as being married? Did you feel rebellious against that, or you just were interested in other things?
The way it happened was where I decided to go to college, in an all-boys college, mostly boys college, to study business. And that was a college my father had been to and my grandfather had been to. And when I decided to go there, I got into the program, my mother said, no way. So that's when my rebellion started. Until then, there wasn't an active disagreement because I was happily pursuing my interests and my mother was, you know, making her plans for my life. But that led me on a hunger strike. So I decided I wanted to go to that college and she said she wasn't going to let me do that. So I said, no, I was going to go there because that was the only college that offered business programs, a commerce program for women. And that was also an hour away. I had to take a train as opposed to going to the college next door. So after a day and a half, almost 2 days of a hunger strike, she gave up. The nun from my convent school where I went to school came out of the convent for the very first time that I remember to kind of plead with my mother, you know, she's a good girl, you know, you really need to send her to the school she wants to go to, the college she wants to go to. So that was my first act of rebellion.
What was it about business that made you say, I have to be in this program?
I wanted to do something that was not traditional because what I was geared to do was to become, you know, to study literature, which was the program in English. I was good in English. I adopted a lot of the school stuff and it was expected that that's what I would do. But then when I got into this very new program, very prestigious program, I suddenly said I wanted to go there. And then the moment the boundaries were put on me, I started to rebel and said, why not? I guess if nobody had put a boundary, I wasn't that passionate about business as such. I think it was more that the boundary was put on me that I couldn't go to this college. And I'd grown up with stories about this college because it's a very, very, it's a 185-year-old college at this moment. It's one of the oldest colleges. And my grandfather, who was the love of my life, would feed me stories of the Scottish principals that founded the college and just a Jesuit college. So I grew up with that. And then suddenly there was this college that my father and grandfather had gone to. And it had this program which was unique and actually took in a few girls. So why would I not go there? And why are you telling me I can't go there? And that was what the spirit was. So I wasn't actively thinking about rebelling or going towards something at that moment. And by the way, a lot of my friends at that moment didn't have that experience. They didn't. Many of them ended up staying there and settling in that same place because it was a very simple existence where it wasn't written that you were going to go out and blaze brave new trails in the world. That wasn't the story that was written for you.
So, Chandrika wrote her own story and enrolled at Madras Christian College, something not common for women at the time. Every day she traveled an hour each way, slowly building her independence away from her family who, at the time, still expected her to simply get married.
Well, the first place that you blazed trails was being one of the only women in this college. What was that like?
It was incredible. And in fact, some of those 3 years were some of the best years of my life. So it was an incredibly sort of liberating experience for me. I also did well in college. You know, I was sort of the valedictorian. And that gave me a great sense of confidence in the sense of I explored these other dimensions. I was studying, I was doing a lot of music. I did lots of skits with the guys. You know, we did a lot of plays. There were many dimensions explored. So it wasn't a very unidimensional education.
Did you go to business school immediately after?
Right.
So this was the next phase of rebellion.
So my professor, because I'd done well in college, he said to me, you should apply to this business school, which takes, you know, there are about over 100,000 applicants and 100 people get in. But normally the people that apply are 2 to 3 years ahead in terms of they've done a 5-year degree engineering program and had a couple of years of work experience. That's the typical profile of the students that get in. Whereas I had just had a 3-year degree. And in that, I'd already skipped a year of school, so I was so young. But my professor said you should apply.
Originally, she had set her sights on law school. She loved logic and reasoning, and her grandfather was a judge. It seemed only natural. But a switch flipped in her after a frustrating conversation with her uncle.
He said to me, oh, if I were you, I wouldn't bother because it's like getting a Nobel Prize, you know, you really won't get in. That lunch finished and I went home and I said, I want to go to this business school. I mean, I'm like, so it was almost like, how dare you tell me I can't go? Again, it wasn't that I had this burning passion to do business or anything. That's what happened when, and I think this has been the pattern, you know, when somebody says to me, you absolutely cannot do it. When the boundary is put on me, I kind of like to think about why do I have this boundary? Then give me a good reason for the boundary.
Yeah.
And I don't want a boundary I don't understand. And I rebel.
Now with her sights solidly set on business school, she still had the matter of her family. Her mother continued to pursue an arranged marriage for her, traditional for the firstborn, especially the firstborn daughter.
So while college was finishing, I was almost 18. So every time my classmates would come, my mother would say, oh, you're going to, you know, you just wait and see. She's going to be married. She's going to be married. I'm going to find her. It was going to be an arranged marriage. She had this. And I understand that because, you know, I was the first daughter, the first child of the family. I had to uphold the honor. And if I had gone astray in any way, that would have been a bad thing for the honor of the family. And I was told this from the time practically that I was born, you know.
So you wanted to go to business school.
Right.
And we came to the second hunger strike.
The second hunger strike. Yes, that's exactly it. But by now I was an expert on hunger strikes. So the second time was clear. And my professor from college came in. Again, he brought an army of three guys who were in that business school. And he spoke to my mother to say, you've got to let her go. And finally, she relented. And then once I went to business school, I kind of flew away. I basically left home. I was no longer under the control of mother, because by then I had a job, and then I rebelled. I genuinely rebelled, you know. I changed my clothes. So I kind of decided to be me, as opposed to be the sweet daughter of a traditional household and do all the things I was expected to do. So I moved in by myself into an apartment. I went to Beirut after business school in the middle of the Civil War.
This was once the richest part of the richest city in the Middle East. Now it's the front line of the war in the Lebanon. Buildings where last year the money makers of the Western world exchanged their millions are now the barricades of Beirut. The war has lasted 12 months. It has ruined a country and destroyed a nation. There is supposed to be a ceasefire in the Lebanon, but it means nothing. There have been 28 ceasefires, and each of them has been followed by even fiercer fighting.
In Beirut, ceasefires don't usually last long.
And in Beirut, it was 1975. It was the worst civil war you can imagine. And it was, and Citibank had given us apartments in El Rauche, which is on the seaside. And we would, for the first few weeks were fine, maybe 3-4 weeks were fine. Then the shelling started. You know, we would actually go to the office in the daytime and come back in the evening and buildings would be burning on either side, or an entire block would have been shelled. And in the middle of the night, sometimes they would call us all and tell us, please evacuate your apartments and go to the Holiday Inn, because they would want all the Citibank trainees to be in a safe place. But interestingly enough, a few months later, the whole Holiday Inn was razed to the ground. But there's a certain innocence that you didn't know what you were into. And I think this is war and what was happening. And I, at that time, would still be wearing a sari. I didn't own any Western clothes. And I'd happily walk around Beirut in a sari. And one time, I'll never forget, I walked into, from my apartment, I just walked to a street and two men with tanks, and I spoke French. So the two men with tanks were standing there. And then they said to me, we are going to spare you because you're Indian, but please go back to your apartment. Don't come to this area. So I had some near misses, but I was so naive and so innocent. There was an incredible movie called Lust for Life, story of Vincent van Gogh. And I've been wanting to see this movie. And it was playing in a Beirut theater, in the main theater in Beirut. So a friend of mine and I, we had like no money. So we knew the tickets were like £2 or something. So we decided to go to the theater and say, you know, they're shelling all around. We might as well just go to the theater. So we went there and the guy says to us, it's £400 is the price. We're like, why £400? He said, because you're the only two in the theater and I have to do the whole, I have to run the movie for you. So that £400 was the entire savings from the entire few months we had. So we said, no, thank you, and went back. And that evening, that theater was razed to the ground. It was razed to the ground. So the next morning, when we went to work, the theater didn't exist.
Do you think that had a lasting impact on your perspective moving forward?
It made me understand what hatred and anger can do to such beautiful places and people, because people's emotions were so high. And we were innocent and sort of shielded from what was actually happening. But Beirut is probably one of the most beautiful places in the world. The mountain meets the sea in its most majestic way. And the streets were like, the Alhambra was like one of the most beautiful streets. They're like, it's like Paris on steroids. And everything was destroyed. The relics were destroyed. The history was destroyed. And many friends who are Lebanese, and I've sort of kept up with what has happened. And so it just tells you that hatred and war don't really can destroy things forever. Beirut will never regain its majesty. So it colored me that way, that we all have to be really aware of the consequences.
Chandrika was one of the last of the Citibank employees to evacuate. From there, she moved to Calcutta and Bombay
and continued to work for Citibank until she was interviewed for a job at McKinsey. Unsurprisingly, she got the job and moved across the pond to New York City. We're going to take a short break for some ads.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing
right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now back to the show.
And you arrived in the winter with no Western clothes, right?
No Western clothes. I had a, you know, it was a blizzard. It was that amazingly horrible blizzard of January. It was end of January. I hadn't really seen snow until then. I don't think I'd seen snow. I've never seen snow until then. And I came from a town when the weather became 80 degrees. Everyone would say, oh, make sure you take your shawl. Because we're so used to 100 degree and 105 is like the normal temperature. Yeah. At 80, you might catch a cold, you know. And here I was in the middle of this thing and I'd borrowed a size 12 coat. I was about a size zero at that time. I weighed nothing. But somebody lent me a huge thin coat. And I had a yellow silk sari. I still have that sari and open-toed slippers. And I was traipsing around the blizzard of New York in the McKinsey. To be fortunate, it was like a three-block walk from the hotel, the Middletown Hotel, to McKinsey's offices on 46th Street. But I'll never forget the bone-chilling cold of my open toes touching the icy snow. And then my feet are sinking in, my sari is sinking in. And then I'm going out to do 16 interviews over the next 2 days.
Oh,
I had a yellow sari and a blue sari, and I had just those. And you know, there are thick silks and there are thin silks. And I had the thinnest silk you can imagine. And nobody ever asked me, are you planning to change your clothes once you join us?
Oh, that's interesting.
No one asked me that because they knew I was truly FOB, fresh off the boat. Truly, because I didn't have the runway that people have when you come to university here. Mm-hmm. When you come to university, you can make all your mistakes. You know, it's a very endearing, loving, cherished environment. You have classmates, you have professors, you're taken care of, you have student services. I had none of that. I went straight, I came in, into the interviews and then into the boardrooms.
Wow. So what was that like once you moved here? Must have been a huge culture shock.
My first week, my first day that I came into McKinsey, I think it was like the Thursday or something, and then the senior partner I was assigned to called me up and he said, well, we are going to New Jersey on Monday morning. Our client is Nabisco. And I expect you will be in New Jersey at 8 o'clock in the morning. We have a meeting with the CEO. I'm saying, okay. I mean, typically it's like someone says jump, you're supposed to say how high. And that's the training I had. And remember, McKinsey was like the brainiacs of the brainiacs. Very small firm, very prestigious. And this was a fantastically senior partner. So I didn't really know how to drive. So this is a Friday that he's telling me this. So I call up various, I don't know many people in New York either. So I try to find a driving school from the Yellow Pages. So all weekend, I drove in Queens. I found a guy and I didn't have much money either. I mean, they've given me a check, which I haven't yet cashed. So I'm basically going and driving around. I found somebody who would cheaply teach me driving. I had a license which was from India, which was like, I would say it's a bribe license because, you know, I needed an international license. That's what I had. I, without much, I mean, I passed a test, but I didn't have any experience. So I drove for like 8 hours, but this was in the streets of Queens. So Monday morning, I'm supposed to be in New Jersey, in Parsippany, New Jersey at 8 a.m. So I look up the Atlas and just figure out it's going to be an hour to get there. I've never driven on any highway. I don't know about slow lanes and fast lanes. So I go on the, I leave 4 hours before the 8 o'clock. I left home at 4:30 or something. And I'm sitting on the slowest lane and I'm driving at about 5 miles an hour because I'm so scared to drive because I've never driven. I'm saying I don't want to hit anyone. But of course, everyone's giving me the finger. And I'm waving to everybody because I'm thinking how friendly America is. That. But all they're doing is like, you ass, get off the fast lane. You're slowing up traffic. Because by then I was going so slowly that, you know, I was in the rush hour, you know, by 6:37 on my way to New Jersey, whatever it was. And so finally I reached New Jersey in time. I made it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the other thing. You know, in America, the roads bank. You know, they're slightly indented. I mean, they're slightly inclined. And you don't notice that. So I thought, of course, I'd never really driven. So I wasn't sure what the angle of the car was supposed to be. So I'm stopping the car in the middle of the highway, opening the door to make sure I don't have a flat tire. Because it somehow feels like I have flat tires on one or two sides. But I wouldn't have known what to do. So I'm thinking, I want to make sure I don't have a flat tire. So these ridiculous thoughts are going through my head. And then I arrive in New Jersey. And then I learn my ropes.
How did you stay focused? I mean, you advanced quite quickly within McKinsey. Your work must have been exceptional. How did you stay focused with so much to learn about everything around you?
You know, this basically was really my training ground. I learned so much about myself. I learned so much about how to deal with people. And I learned that I'm capable of a lot more than I think I am. You know, you're the Winnie the Pooh saving, the saying, you're braver than you believe, you're stronger than you seem. And I think that's really, I lived that Winnie the Pooh maxim in a way. Because in every setting, I had problems. I had challenges. CEOs, senior executives from the banking industry, which is one of the most traditional industries, who've never really had a woman in the boardroom or in any senior position, certainly not an Indian woman who spoke funny, who spoke fast, who spoke differently and didn't have any common ground with them. So people would find the most ridiculous ways to find common ground. This is, I'm talking of 1979, 1980. Nobody, people just knew of India as you know, somebody that cows were on the road. The Taj Mahal, everyone would ask me about the Taj Mahal. I hadn't even seen the Taj Mahal myself. And then everybody would tell me about that one Indian friend they had from some part of the world. And they'd say, are you related to them? And I'd want to explain to them that it was me, did have 800 million people. And, you know, so yeah, possibly, but didn't sound likely. But after a while, you know, this became a, I started to think about it because every time I would have this feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, oh, wow, why are they talking to me like this? And, but they wouldn't do this to anyone else. Then I decided, you know, they're doing this because they're trying to find common ground. I gave them the best, I ascribed the best intention to them. And I think the second thing which I made as a policy is that I decided that when I walked into a room, I wouldn't think of myself as a woman. I wouldn't think of myself as having come from India or not, whatever it is. When I walked into a room as a McKinsey associate or a partner, whatever I walked into the room because I was the best there is. I had done an incredible amount of work. I knew a lot about the issue I was talking about. I was so well prepared. I was there to deliver what I came in for. I was very clear. I was very confident. And if we wanted to debate the issues, we're happy to debate them. So there was no extraneous noise in my head. I never walked in unprepared. I worked harder than anyone I knew. I was an expert in whatever I did. Whatever I didn't know, if people pointed it out to me, I went and fixed it. So that was my motto. And I cared a lot about what my clients thought. I cared a lot about delivering value. So my mantra was impact. That's what my life in McKinsey was about, what my life in my firm was about.
Chandrika's success in the world of business cannot be overstated. After over a decade at McKinsey, working as the lead on some of the largest mergers and accounts, she left to start her own firm, Tandon Capital Associates, in 1992. Business took off. In fact, anyone that she worked with had to report it to the SEC because their stock would immediately change. Yet throughout all her business achievements, it was music that continued to play in the back of her mind. That what if that we all have, and it bubbled its way to the surface.
I sang before I could speak. I will tell you how. Fatal is Cupid's bow. I did, you know, I told you, we came from a very simple house. I had so many jobs, you know, at 4 a.m. or 4:30, the milkman would come and you had to stand there and watch him milk the cow. And that was all my job. We had those jobs. So I'd just be singing from that time on. There'd be a radio station always playing music. So music was in my brain. And in fact, I learned music when I was younger and then stopped because I went into the whole business world in an intense way. But I was still, I wasn't singing. But 1999, I had an epiphany, crisis of spirit. I just said, I have to really look at my life and see what makes me happy and what really would make my life complete. And that's when I said, I'm living in such a selfish bubble of war. You know, I was very successful in my work, very successful company, had lots of money. No one gave it to me. I made everything myself. I came in with nothing. But I wasn't living a useful life in that sense. And so I wanted to expand my definition of what my life was about. And it was a particularly difficult thing to do because I was poised to take on a very, very large deal, which would have vaulted my company into another realm. It would have been personally very taxing. It's a mega deal in Europe where I'd have had to spend a lot of time there. But I decided I had to stop, pause, and think about intentionally how I wanted to spend my time. And I decided that whatever I did, I still wanted to do my business, but music had to be part of it. My happiest times had to do with music, where I was singing with people, by myself, and I just didn't have time to do that, much of that. And the second thing I decided is that I wanted to do something that didn't just involve me. I wanted to clearly have a life of service of some kind, where I did, even if it's a random act of kindness, that I would measure myself every day by something good I did. No one needed to know it, but I was going to do that. So I'd done enough for myself. And that was my commitment. So it's almost like this whole thing was a conversation with myself. And that's when I went back to music and I started to beg people to teach me because I wanted to learn. I didn't want to perform. It wasn't for any of that. I wanted to sing and I wanted to sing really well. So I wanted to learn from the masters. And in India, no masters will teach you when you are in your 40s, you know, because they take people to become their pupils when they're five. And they, you know, the system is that you move in, you give up. It's unidimensional. If you're an artist, you don't do anything else. Whereas here I wasn't going to give up the rest of my life. I just wanted to sing for a few hours a day. And no master was interested. But then little by little, when they would work with me, they would see. So then everybody would say, oh, you're so good. You really now need to spend all your time. Come with me, perform with me. But I couldn't do that either. I wasn't going to walk away from my family. I wasn't going to walk away from my company. I had a daughter. So it was balancing these dimensions and consciously creating a multidimensional life with music as a big piece of it and service and my business and my family became a very important juggling act. But I said, ultimately that became my definition of success as well. Success to me then wasn't about money. Success was simply having the freedom to do exactly what you wanted and that it in the way that makes you most happy. And so to me, that's kind of how my life ended up completely getting redefined.
So from a functional perspective, how did you divide up, now that you've decided that you have these three prongs that you're going to work on, your business, your music, and your service, did you go like for a couple weeks in one bucket at a time and then switch? Did you do all three at the same time? What did it functionally look like for you?
So the first thing I did is I decided not to do this mega deal. So I decided I wasn't going to do deals that involved me going away from home for months on end, living in different countries. That's what I was doing. So I said I was going to restructure the business side of what I was going to do. But you know, there's a Rumi saying which says when you take one step towards the divine, the divine takes 10 steps towards you. And there's a universal synchronicity, you know, when you decide you really want, when it's the right thing to do. And truly, that's what happened.
Chandrika took a step back, looking for a new way to engage that could live at the intersection of music and business. The universe truly rose to meet her when she was offered a position to teach at NYU for just a few hours a week. When we come back, Chandrika talks about her new role at NYU and how her work there allowed her to pursue music and art.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
She's breathing right now? Yes, she's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Now back to the show.
Next thing I know, I'm there 3 days a week. I'm teaching classes. I'm working on strategy projects. I'm with the dean like his shadow, you know. And we were restructuring the school. We were doing so many great things. So since I had an office at the business school, I was doing my business there as well. But then I started to just do music very religiously. So I would find teachers and fly the teachers in or take breaks in between. Or just say, okay, I'm going to go to India for 2 weeks when my daughter was in camp. And I would not schedule deals at that time. So it requires planning. It requires very, as they say, you know, your calendar decides what you do. You can say all the things you like, but ultimately you have to look at your calendar, right? You can say, I want to do music, but if you're not singing in your calendar at all, what does it mean? So I had to really work to organize myself. And I had a lot of help, universe's help, between NYU and then NYU also. Then that's how I got engaged with NYU. So the Stern School, and then one thing led to another. Then they invited me to the board, and then I started to get more and more engaged.
Yeah, what was the connection there? So you gave and named the Tandon School of Engineering, but very tied in with art, and very tied in with art.
Right. So the art side, see, my sort of life goals have really been around two themes. One is economic empowerment, letting everybody have economic empowerment. And I think technology is a very big way to get economic empowerment because technology is changing every industry in ways like here we are sitting and talking to the world in microphones and podcasts and all of that. The music industry, the visual arts industry, the medical industry, everything is changing. And we ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, it's a wave. And so to me, that was a reason. So economic empowerment to me is a very important part of where I'd like to focus my attention. And so the investment of the engineering school was because I just saw that investing in that would really empower whole generations of kids to be tech savvy and to be changed. Because once they graduate from engineering school, they're able to get fantastic jobs. And so so that was one angle. When we invested in the school, a very big proportion of the school was first generation, first in the family to go to college, and a lot of women. So it was exactly the group that I wanted to touch in whatever way we could. The second side of the empowerment is emotional empowerment through music, which to me, my lesson from my own life is that music was a great joy to me. But most importantly, music helped me find myself. Because to really be a good musician, you have to have a quiet mind for the kind of music I do. You have to quiet all your senses. You have to quiet your thoughts. And the more you quiet your thoughts, you start to get into this deep place of joy, this place of bliss, this place of deep meditation. So for me, music was my gateway into meditation, into deep states of transcendence and finding a greater joy. And that's why the music and the service have gone hand in hand. Because once you feel that sense of deep connection, not just with yourself, but then you feel it with everyone. You feel it with the world. You really want to be connected. You feel we're all one. You feel you want to serve more. And so to me, that's been my journey. So I wanted to really have music be part of what we do to heal, to for people to find their own center. So every album I've done has been variations of that idea.
À la claire fontaine, mon allant promener, j'ai trouvé l'eau si belle que je m'y suis baignée. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime jamais.
A Grammy-nominated artist, Chandrika has performed all over the world, from Lincoln Center to the Kennedy Center to the India World Culture Festival. And she shows no signs of stopping.
The newest album I have started out as just as singing to my grandchildren. And then I put all those songs together because I wanted to leave that behind for them. But this has turned into something more because I've been just singing these songs now with the children in Ukraine, in Prague, with the refugees, children in Ukraine. And then I've just done this in Washington, D.C. And so it's become such an expression of intergenerational love where people can sing together across ages, across borders. And most of these children, not most, no one spoke English. And yet they were singing these songs in English. They wanted to do these chants in Sanskrit. So the journey I'm on in this next phase of my life is part of this, one of the key parts of the journey I'm on is to really use music to sing with people. And to sing with all ages in different languages as a way of building community, as a way of building connection. Because I think it's a huge, music knows no boundaries and music can heal. You don't need to be A or B or C to come together and need song. Mm. So that's my journey right now.
Do you think there's a piece that brings you back to your formative relationship with your grandfather, that now you can have this sing-along moment with your grandchildren?
Absolutely. And what I think has been the biggest revelation in this part of my journey now is that it started out as a gift to my grandchildren, but I suddenly feel like I have hundreds of thousands of grandchildren because whether it was in Prague or in Washington, the children wanted as many hugs as anything else, and they loved singing. And I just got, so the reaction from the children and from myself, I just feel this love blossoming in a very dramatic fashion, mm-hmm. which I never thought possible.
Mm.
You know, because it was initially, it was a fairly narrow view, but now it's expanded so much. So
yeah,
it's a wonderful flowering.
What is one thing when you look back that you feel like in the time you thought, oh, this is a low, like this is really terrible. But now in retrospect, you see it as having really set you up for the successful person that you are now.
I would say the crisis of spirit, because there was something so traumatic and dramatic about walking away from this mega deal, you know, and where I lost all my moorings. I had defined myself as a business person. My success, quote unquote, was the big business successes I had. I was in every newspaper. You know, I was an SEC. I was a disclosable event. If a company hired me, they needed to disclose it to the SEC because the stock price would go up. And the board. And this was one I thought I'd lost my mind. Because here I came on a plane. I mean, I just met with the board all day Friday. So I left Europe on Friday evening and I was on the plane. I was the only passenger in first class. And I start crying. Who does that? Not me. I was not the crying sort. This is not, I've told you my earlier part of my life. I'm a tough cookie in a sense, you know. But here I am just crying and it's not like something's fallen apart. I was just so lost because I didn't know what I was doing. do I want to sign this deal? And then fortunately, there were no cell phones at that time. Nobody could reach me because they needed to announce it to the, they were doing a press release on Tuesday or Wednesday, but we needed to sign the contract. I just told them, let me go back to New York and let me do the final sign on the dotted line once I get back and think about it. But in their mind, it was a done deal. And we'd had 5-6 months of negotiations to do this deal. So it was not even just a low point. It was a complete deconstruction of who I was and having to put myself back together again in a non-accidental fashion. I was an accidental person until then, and I became a more intentional person after that. That was the biggest transition. But when I was in there, I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I thought I was just like having a crying jag. Maybe I was premenopausal. I mean, I put so many labels on this because I didn't know, but it really was the luckiest thing that ever happened to me. The luckiest thing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved talking to you, Emily.
Chandrika is continuing to create music and use her platform and resources to, as she says, elevate human happiness. Be sure to follow Chandrika on all social media platforms at Chandrika Tandon to stay up to date on all of her amazing happenings. Thanks for listening to this episode of She Pivots. If you made it this far, you're a true pivoter, so thanks for being part of this community. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, leave us a rating. Please be nice. Tell your friends about us. To learn more about our guests, follow us on Instagram at ShePivotsThePodcast or sign up for our newsletter where you can get exclusive behind-the-scenes content or on our website, ShePivotsThePodcast. Talk to you next week. Special thanks to the She Pivots team, executive producer Emily Edovolosik, associate producer and social media connoisseur Hannah Cousins, research director Christine Dickison, events and logistics coordinator Madeline Sinovic, and audio editor and mixer Nina Pollack.
I endorse She Pivots.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.